Avram is in Japan at the moment, so that's why I'm here instead. So we'll see what happens. Is everybody here? Is it presumably? Yeah. Okay. We can just presume we can start. Yeah. Okay. There's one coming back there. No way. Okay. So today I'm going to look at a sutta number 48 in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's called the Kosambya Sutta. So if you want to look up sutta number 48. This sutta I have chosen for one particular reason, and that reason is that it is concerned with the qualities of a stream enterer, Sotapanna, and by extension is actually concerned with the qualities of anybody who is an Aryan, anybody who has seen the Dhamma, who has actually penetrated to understand the teachings of the Buddha. And these people who are who have penetrated the teaching called Aryans, and the least one of the Aryans is a Sotapanna. And this sutta concerns the qualities of such a Sotapanna, how you can recognize in a sense a Sotapanna. And I think it's quite important to have a little bit of knowledge about these things, because sometimes when it's quite handy when you, for example, you see monks and you wonder, you know, where to place your faith, and or you see lay people, or you see whoever basically, where to place your faith, where not to have faith. It's quite nice to know a little bit about the qualities which these Aryans actually have. Then you can make a little bit of judgment. You can't take a judgment too far, because sometimes you just don't know. But you can at least make some judgment on the about these matters. So that's why I find it quite, personally I find it quite useful in my life. That's why I also want to maybe share a reading about this particular sutta. There is one event in the sutta which is actually talked about before we get to the actual aspects about the qualities of the stream enterer, and that is an event which is known in the sutta as the quarrel of Kosambi, which is an argument between the monks in Kosambi. I'm just going to briefly touch on that first of all, because it has some nice and inspiring verses which the Buddha taught in that connection. I thought what might be nice to read out, because the sutta is quite short otherwise. Okay, so this is how the sutta begins on page 419 in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of the Majjhima Nikaya. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Kosambi in Gosita's park. Now, on that occasion, the bhikkhus at Kosambi had taken to quarreling and brawling, and were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. They could neither convince each other nor be convinced by others. They could neither persuade each other nor be persuaded by others. So this is famous quarrel in Kosambi between the monks. And what they were arguing about, believe it or not, was a tiny little point of Vinaya regarding etiquette around toilets. That's what they were arguing about. And this argument became really massive, really, really big. And it threatened actually to split the Sangha. It threatened almost to get a schism in the Sangha because of this particular event. And actually, in the monks' Vinaya, there's actually a long discussion of what happens in the event of where the Sangha is threatened to become schismatic, to actually separate. And this the reason for that part in the Vinaya is because of the quarrel at Kosambi. So it's quite a lot which comes in the Vinaya because of this particular quarrel. So the Buddha's response in this particular sutta is to give this teaching about who are Aryans and not. And later on, the Buddha decides to leave Kosambi because even these monks were disputing and brawling and quarreling with each other. At the end of the day, they don't even listen to the Buddha. So the Buddha decides the only lesson he can give them is to actually leave Kosambi altogether and go somewhere on his own. And then maybe they will understand that this is going too far. So I'll turn briefly to Sutta number 128. It's called the Upakilesa Sutta. If you want to follow me on that one, it's this is the continuation of the Kosambya Sutta, and this is where after the Buddha has tried to settle this dispute in Kosambi, he's not able to settle it, then he speaks these particular verses, and these verses are also found in the Dhammapada on page 1009. And this is what the Buddha says in response to this quarrel at Kosambi. When many voices shout at once, none considers himself a fool. Though the Sangha is being split, none thinks himself to be at fault. They have forgotten thoughtful speech. They talk obsessed by words alone. Uncurbed their mouths, they brawl at will. None knows what leads him so to act. He abused me, he struck me, he defeated me, he robbed me. In those who harbor thoughts like these, hatred will never be allayed. It's one of the famous Dhammapada verses. For in this world, hatred is never allayed by further acts of hate. It is allayed by non-hatred. This is the fixed and ageless law. Those others do not recognize that here we should restrain ourselves. But those wise ones who realize this at once end all the enmity. Again, verses from Dhammapada. Breakers of bones and murderers, those who steal cattle, horses, wealth, those who pillage the entire realm, when even these can act together, why can you not do so too? If one can find a worthy friend, a virtuous, steadfast companion, then overcome all threats of danger and walk with him content and mindful. But if one finds no worthy friend, no virtuous, steadfast companion, then as a king leaves his conquered realm, walk like a tusker in the woods alone. Better it is to walk alone. There is no companionship with fools. Walk alone and do no evil, at ease like a tusker in the woods. Yes. Yeah. Yes, I think that's part of it. It's probably part of the restraint is just not to let it come out. But the other aspect is probably to try to overcome that inner anger as well. It's probably twofold. Yeah, so you have to restrain yourself so it doesn't come out, and secondly, you also have to try to sort of overcome the inner hatred through skillful thinking, try to look at the situation differently, whatever means you can, have at your disposal basically. But obviously, the first act is to refrain yourself so it doesn't actually come out. That's obviously the first thing to do. Okay, that's only a little bit of a diversion really from the main sutta, so. We'll go back to number 48 again here. So one of the reasons I wanted to read that out is because sometimes people tend to think that, well, at the time of the Buddha, people were so pure and they were so good and they were so so wholesome and they had all these paramis and they had all these merits that were built up over centuries and over millennia, even over life, many, many lifetimes. But when you actually read the suttas, you actually find quite a number of places just like this, where you see that people in the time of the Buddha weren't all that different from what they are today. They argued, they had their defilements, they had all these problems they were dealing with. Basically, people have always been people. And the nice thing about that is, of course, that, well, if they could become enlightened, if they could practice the path, so can we. People are people. And it's important to recognize that and not just think, wow, they had all these paramis, because that only blocks one's own practice on practicing the path. Okay, so the Buddha then goes on and his response to this quarrel going on in Kosambi at this time. Then a certain monk went to the Blessed One and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and informed him of what was happening. Then the Blessed One addressed a certain bhikkhu thus, "Come, bhikkhu, tell those monks in my name that the teacher calls them." "Yes, venerable sir," he replied, And he went to those monks and told them, "The teacher calls the venerable ones." "Yes, friend," they replied, and they went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, they sat down at one side. The Blessed One then asked them, "Bhikkhus, is it true that you are taken to quarreling and brawling and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, that you can neither convince each other nor be convinced by others, that you can neither persuade each other nor be persuaded by others?" "Yes, venerable sir." "Monks, what do you think? When you take to quarreling and brawling and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, do you on that occasion maintain acts of loving kindness by body, speech and mind, in public and in private, towards your companions in the holy life?" "No, venerable sir." "So, monks, when you take to quarreling and brawling and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, on that occasion you do not maintain acts of loving kindness by body, speech and mind, in public and in private, towards your companions in the holy life. Misguided men, what can you possibly know, what can you see, that you take to quarreling and brawling and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, that you can neither convince each other nor be convinced by others, that you can neither persuade each other nor be persuaded by others? Misguided men, that will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time." It is interesting in a particular sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, on a similar topic, it actually says quite clearly, quite specifically, that the only way to have progress in your meditation practice is actually to live in harmony. If you live in a community in dispute, then you cannot actually have progress in your meditation practice. Because there is something called, sometimes called the transcendental dependent arising, and it shows how through a number of causes all these good qualities come to be. And one of the minimum causes, one of the early causes, is a factor called pamuja, which means basically like gladness or happiness in the heart of to some extent. And for this happiness to rise, it's going to have to be there has to be harmony to some extent. If there's obviously lots of brawling and disputing and as it says in the sutta, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, then obviously there isn't enough harmony for happiness to arrive in the community. And when happiness, that pamuja doesn't arise, then pity doesn't arise. Pity is the next factor on this list, which is mentioned very frequently in the sutta. Pamuja leads to pity. Pity leads to tranquility. Tranquility leads to sukha, happiness. And happiness leads to samadhi. And only when you have this samadhi, can you actually have deep insights. So what this sutta and Anguttara Nikaya is saying is that if you haven't got harmony, you haven't got a basis for any kind of practice. And that is one of the reasons why Ajahn Brahm, for example, puts a lot of effort on harmony certainly in the monastery, but I presume also in the Buddhist society, because it is like the foundation stone, one of the foundation stones for successful practice. Then the Blessed One addressed the monks thus: "Bhikkhus, there are these six principles of cordiality that create love and respect and conduce to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. What are the six?" "Here a monk maintains bodily acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards his companions in the holy life. This is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity." Note here that the acts of loving kindness are to be both in private and in public. As I think it's pretty obvious reasons why that is. Obviously, if you are going to have a strong loving kindness in your practice, you're going to have to start off practicing it in private. And then when you build up some steam in private, then you can actually also have that loving kindness in public. And also, obviously, if you're going to succeed in your meditation practice, then you're going to have a pure mind when you stay by yourself, when you meditate by yourself. And that purity of mind is very often, of course, gotten by practicing metta practice. So obviously the metta in private is obviously very important. Again, a monk maintains verbal acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards his companions in the holy life. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to unity. Again, a monk maintains mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards his companions in the holy life. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to unity. So we see here that loving kindness, one way of practicing loving kindness is of course to do like what we often do, like a formal loving kindness meditation. But even just doing acts of loving kindness to, you know, verbally, kind speech, kind actions, this also is called loving kindness practice. Often this is a good place to start, because often the metta meditation itself can be quite difficult sometimes. Again, a monk uses things in common with his virtuous companions in the holy life. Without making reservations, he shares with them any gain of a kind that accords with the Dhamma and has been obtained in a way that accords with the Dhamma, including even the contents of his alms bowl. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to unity. So here we have one of the basic principles of Dhamma. You have virtue, and then you have generosity. It's very interesting that the Buddha, he doesn't just teach generosity to lay people, to lay Buddhists, but generosity is also a very important practice also for monks and nuns, of course. And this is what you see here. So basically, you share everything that you have. You have to have this open-heartedness of always being willing to share if you're going to practice the Dhamma to its full extent. There is a... Actually, I'll read out a small passage about generosity, because it is a... You may have read it before, but it's quite a nice explanation of what true generosity actually is according to the Buddha. Let's see if I can. I should have it here, actually. This is the standard passage which the Buddha always quotes on generosity. And this here is a very high. This is what he calls accomplishment in generosity. And he says it is as follows. Here, a noble disciple dwells at home with a mind free from the stain of stinginess, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, one devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. This is called accomplishment in generosity. This is the standard passage on how generosity is stated in the suttas when you actually practice it to a very high extent. The fact that you always, almost any opportunity you sort of take to share what you have and to give to charity whatever else you feel inclined to give to. And it is said in one sutta, in a number of suttas, but in one sutta particularly, that if you have any kind of stinginess in your heart, it's impossible to enter deep samadhi. Stinginess is actually something which stops you, blocks you from entering deep samadhi. I'm talking particularly about the jhanas. So you have to have this sense of willingness to let go of your own things and willingness to share, even to practice the Dhamma fully. So it is actually a very important principle in Buddhism, both for monks and for lay people alike. This is now the fifth point, which leads to cohesion, etc. Again, a monk dwells both in public and in private, possessing in common with his companions in the holy life those virtues that are unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmottled, liberating, commended by the wise, not misapprehended, and conducive to concentration. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to unity. So here we have the other basic aspect of the Dhamma, the aspect of virtue, which comes into the picture. And of course, again, virtue is of course one of the very foundation stones for the practice of the Dhamma. And that's why it comes in here. It's interesting to note in this paragraph, you have all these adjectives, if you like, explaining the kind of virtue which is meant. And one of the words here is a word not misapprehended. In the Pali, it's apparamattani. And it's interesting, this is very closely related to a word which is used for the stream enterer, that the stream enterer doesn't misapprehend silabatta, vows and rituals, it's often called. It also means like virtue and vows. And the point is that according to the suttas of the Buddha, just being virtuous is not enough to become fully enlightened. You also have, first off, you start with virtue, but then you develop and you go beyond virtue. You have the deep samadhis, you have the insight wisdoms, etc. And this is what is meant here by not misapprehending, that you don't think that virtue in its own right is sufficient to take you all the way to the end of the path. There is much more to the path than just virtue. Virtue is just like a foundation stone, in a sense, in Buddhism. Albeit a very, very important one, of course. Okay, the sixth quality. Again, a bhikkhu dwells both in public and in private, possessing in common with his companions in the holy life that view that is noble and emancipating, and leads one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. Okay, this view, which leads to, which is noble and emancipating, and leads one who practices according to it to the complete destruction of suffering. Now, this is the view which is attained by the stream enterer upon entering the stream. This is like the full understanding of the Dhamma. This is what is meant here. And this is what happens when you become a stream enterer. You see the Dhamma, so to speak, for the first time. You get a full understanding of the Four Noble Truths, full understanding of the Noble Eightfold Path, and all the other important aspects of the Dhamma you get to understand fully here. Okay. So these are the six principles of cordiality that create love and respect and conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. Of these six principles of cordiality, the chief, the most cohesive, the most unifying, is this view that is noble and emancipating, and which leads the one who practices it practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. Just as the chief, the most cohesive, the most unifying part of a pinnacled house is the pinnacle itself, so too of these six principles of cordiality, the chief is this view that is noble and emancipating. So the point here is that once you actually attain this view of the noble ones, then these other factors fall into place basically automatically. They are, because this is like a support for the other factors here we're talking about here. The view is what actually holds everything together. Just like in a peaked roof, you may have the pinnacle itself, which holds everything else together. Take away the pinnacle, the whole thing collapses. It's the same thing with this right view. This right view holds everything together. It's actually slightly mistranslated here from the Pali. It says here, the most cohesive, the most unifying part. There is actually no most in the Pali. I don't know where that comes from. Maybe it comes from the commentary or something. All the Pali says is that just as the chief, the cohesive, the unifying part of a pinnacle is the house, is the pinnacle itself. So the point here is that the view is what holds this whole structure together, holds all these factors together. And in other places in the suttas, you will see the same thing about a number of categories in the suttas. For example, you have like the five faculties. And the five faculties are held together, work, because of the right view you have as a sotapanna. It's the wisdom and the view which holds this thing together. The same thing with the Noble Eightfold Path. The sotapanna is said to be endowed with the Noble Eightfold Path. Again, it's the right view which gives him that endowment, if you like. So the right view is the is what holds all these things up. And how does this view that is noble and emancipating lead the one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering? And now we come on to these seven qualities, which are seven qualities of the Sotapanna, by which one can recognize whether somebody has become a Sotapanna, is an Aryan or not. They are listed in sequence here. So the first one of these qualities is as follows. Here a bhikkhu gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut considers thus. Is there any obsession unabandoned in myself that might so obsess my mind that I cannot know or see things as they actually are? If a bhikkhu is obsessed by sensual lust, then his mind is obsessed. If he is obsessed by ill will, then his mind is obsessed. If he is obsessed by sloth and torpor, then his mind is obsessed. If he is obsessed by restlessness and remorse, then his mind is obsessed. If he is obsessed by doubt, then his mind is obsessed. That's of course the five hindrances there. If a bhikkhu is obsessed, or absorbed rather, in speculation about this world, then his mind is obsessed. If a bhikkhu is absorbed in speculation about the other world, then his mind is obsessed. These two are basically speculation about this life and speculation about the afterlife, these two last ones. If a bhikkhu takes to quarreling and brawling and is deep in disputes, stabbing others with verbal daggers, then his mind is obsessed. The last one here, obviously very important, because it refers back to the quarrel in Kosambi. So this is basically the Buddha telling these monks that you are obsessed. This is obsessing your minds, and it's not going to lead you to any anything good. And the next thing, he actually shows these monks that the reason that they are so obsessed by these things is because they're not Sotapannas yet. If they had been Sotapannas, if they had attained to right view, they wouldn't be obsessed in this way. He understands thus, there is no obsession unabandoned in myself that might so obsess my mind that I cannot know or see things as they actually are. My mind is well disposed for awakening to the truths. In other words, the Four Noble Truths is what is meant here. This is the first knowledge attained by him that is noble, supramundane, not shared by ordinary people. So this is interesting, because what one recognizes here is that if you are a Sotapanna, you cannot be obsessed by all these matters. And it means, for example, because the five hindrances are in there, it means that somebody who is a Sekha, somebody who is in training, somebody who is a Sotapanna, always has the ability to abandon the five hindrances if he so needs. They can arise in his mind, but they cannot obsess the mind. And the implied meaning there is seems to be that if you turn your mind to abandoning them, you can abandon them because they don't obsess your mind. So that is why in other suttas, the jhanas, the deep samadhis, are said to be the abidings of the Aryas, in particular the Sotapannas, because they can enter these states with relative ease compared to most other people who might have they might obsessed by these things. And also, of course, you can see there that they don't get obsessed. They don't get obsessed by quarrelling and arguing and all these things. So normally, you would expect somebody who's Sotapanna not to go on arguing at length and certainly not be obsessed by it. Okay, so that is the first quality, if you like, which is enumerated here of a Sotapanna. The second one, again, a noble disciple considers thus, when I pursue, develop, and cultivate this view, Do I obtain internal serenity? Do I personally obtain stillness? And he understands thus, when I pursue, develop, and cultivate this view, I do obtain internal serenity. I personally obtain stillness. This is the second knowledge attained by him that is noble, supramundane, not shared by ordinary people. So basically, because the Sotapanna is said to be endowed with the Noble Eightfold Path, endowed basically means that he knows what the Noble Eightfold Path is, he knows how to practice it. Because he's endowed with that, he knows what has to be done to still his mind. He knows what is the right way and what is the wrong way. An interesting word here, it has obtain internal serenity. The word for Pali word for serenity is nibbuti, nibbuting, which is also a synonym for nibbana. So nibbana is like the highest stillness. So it's also implied in a sense here, it's also implied that he knows the path to nibbana, because he knows how to, he knows that when he develops and cultivates this particular view, he will actually obtain nibbana. That's in a sense what it is saying here. But you can, I cannot really tell that from the English translation. You actually have to look at the Pali here. And of course, the view that he's talking about here, develop and cultivate this view, is basically the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. That is the second quality of the Sotapanna. The third quality of the Sotapanna, again, a noble disciple considers thus, is there any other recluse or Brahmin outside the Buddha's dispensation possessed of a view such as I possess? And he understands thus, there is no other recluse or Brahmin outside the Buddha's dispensation possessed of a view such as I possess. This is the third knowledge attained by him that is noble, supramundane, not shared by ordinary people. This is a very, very interesting statement there. And this ties up with a quality which is often mentioned in the suttas about the Sotapanna. The Sotapanna is incapable of taking anybody except for the Buddha as their teacher. And this, you can see that this ties up with this, because he actually knows that there cannot be any Aryas, any other people who are enlightened outside the Buddha's teaching, when the Buddha's teaching is still around. Because anybody who is obviously would obtain such an insight, they would straight away become the disciples of the Buddha, because they would realize that this, I have just realized what the Buddha taught. So when the Buddha's teaching is around, then it is impossible that somebody should not become the Buddha's disciple who has these insights. So anybody outside the Buddha's teaching will not have this insight, will not have this understanding of the Buddha. And that is why the Sotapanna cannot take anybody except for the Buddha as his teacher. So that is interesting, of course, because straight away you know quite a bit. When you discuss with somebody about the Dhamma, and you discuss with somebody, you can tell quite a bit about where they are coming from. It gives you some insight into their maybe where they are at even when you discuss the Dhamma with them, and see what sort of teaching they take as the teachings, and what sort of teachers they take for the teachers. I find this a very, very interesting point. There is another aspect here which also is quite interesting, which comes in almost under the same heading in a sense. That is, there are not a number of suttas in Dhanguttara Nikaya which show a kind of conditioned sequence of faith that the Sotapanna has. Not really a Sotapanna, but what this sutta says is that when you have faith in the Buddha, then you also have faith in the Dhamma. And the reason for that, of course, is that the Dhamma is something which has been penetrated to, which has been understood by somebody. And because you have faith that the Buddha has penetrated a particular truth and has understood this, well then, of course, you also have faith in the Dhamma, because the Dhamma flows from that penetration, that understanding of something which is very special. Once you have faith in that Dhamma and the Buddha, then you also have faith in the Sangha, because the Sangha are those Aryas, noble ones, which practice according with the Dhamma. So you know that the Dhamma is there, you know that the results of the Dhamma will be of the people also attain to these insights. And then it says, if you have this faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, you also have faith in the training, the Sikkha. because the training is what leads the Aryas to get to this point. And then the fifth one is interesting, I find, is that if you have faith in these four, the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and the training, you also have faith in Samadhi, because Samadhi is such a very important aspect of the training here. And it's not only one sutta, there's many suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya which has this particular sequence. And it may not be obvious straight away what is going on here, but of course the person who has full confidence in the Buddha, that is precisely a sotapanna. This is one of the characteristics of a sotapanna, that somebody has full and complete confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. He cannot take anybody but the Buddha as for his teacher, for her teacher. Now, so if somebody has complete confidence in the Buddha, and you follow the sequence from having confidence in the Buddha, you have confidence in the Dhamma, it goes all the way down to Samadhi, you will actually know straight away that if somebody habitually says bad things about Samadhi, or about the jhanas, for example, as part of Samadhi, you can straight away assume that they cannot be an Arya, they cannot be a sotapanna, because somebody who has faith in the Buddha will by definition also have faith in Samadhi, because these things flow from each other. And this is another fascinating aspect I find of the Dhamma here, which comes across. So this is basically the importance of these teachings of Samadhi in the Buddha's dispensation here. And there are other suttas also which talk about Samadhi and say that, well, if anybody has disrespect for Samadhi, well, that disrespect for Samadhi, together with disrespect, of course, for the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, leads to decline of the sasana. Yeah, well, it's not actually. There's two more coming after that. Panya is not in there. It's I think because Panya might already be sort of assumed in other parts of that sequence. Maybe part of this training, for example, or the Dhamma, exactly. Yeah, probably. Yeah. So these are more particular aspects. Yeah. See, I made some notes. I have to read this. See if I have. Have anything? Yeah. I should maybe also say that when we say that there are no Aryas in rival sects, of course sometimes you hear about these so-called Pacheka Buddhas in Buddhism, these Buddhas which become Buddhas outside the Buddha's dispensation. But this is usually when there is no Buddhist dispensation around that somebody can become fully enlightened. And then they just pass away. They don't actually themselves have a following, and they don't become fully enlightened Buddhas in the sense of Gautama the Buddha, because they don't actually start a dispensation or a teaching, but they still become fully enlightened. So it is possible, but when the Buddha's dispensation is around, then people will become attracted to that dispensation rather than starting another rival sect or anything. Yeah. Okay, that was the third quality, I believe, of the sotapanna. We'll go on to the fourth one. Again, a noble disciple considers thus, do I possess the character of a person who possesses right view? Another word for character might be just the nature of a person. It's a slightly unusual translation. Do I possess the nature of a person who possesses right view? What is the character of a person who possesses right view? This is the character of a person who possesses right view. Although he may commit some kind of offense for which a means of rehabilitation has been laid down, still he at once confesses, reveals, and discloses it to the teacher or to wise companions in the holy life. And having done that, he enters upon restraint for the future. Just as a young, tender infant lying prone at once draws back when it puts his hand or his foot on live coal, so too that is the character of a person who possesses right view. So basically, a sotapanna sees any offense as live coal, which one has to draw away from straight away, because it is so dangerous. Yeah. Yeah, this is also interesting because the Sotapanna elsewhere is said to be somebody who's perfected in virtue. And this gives you some idea what perfection in virtue actually means. It doesn't mean that you never can break any rule whatsoever. Rather, it means that if you do break a rule, and it would normally be a fairly minor rule that you break, you would actually confess it straight away. You wouldn't actually hide it. That's impossible for the Sotapanna to hide something, breaking of an offense. That is the point that is made here. The offenses in the Vinaya are also there are many types of offenses, and some offenses are actually only what you might call conventional offenses. They're not offenses in the sense of being a moral breach, for example. It can just be a convention that this is not what we do in the Buddha's dispensation in Buddhism, and because we don't do it this way, it is an offense to do it otherwise. For example, you have for the monks, there is an offense against storing food overnight. And that is not actually an immoral thing to do, to store food, but it's something which is not allowed for monks. So it's a conventional offense. It was actually an arahat who actually was the originator for that particular offense in the Vinaya. So that shows that it's not actually a immoral act. It's more like just a convention which has been laid down. There are certain offenses in the Vinaya for which he talks here about offenses for which a means of rehabilitation has been laid down. There are certain offenses in the Vinaya, the most severe ones, for which if you break them, you're no longer a monk. You straight away you become disqualified as a monk. You actually don't even have to disrobe, you become a layperson there and then straight away. And the same thing for nuns, they also have these similar offenses. But apart from those, all other offenses they can be rehabilitated from. So that is what is actually what is meant here by this particular phrase. Okay, and then he says here that the Buddha says here, and this person who has right view, he understands thus, I do possess the character of a person who possesses right view. This is the fourth knowledge attained by him that is noble, supramundane, not shared by ordinary people. Again, a noble disciple considers thus, do I possess the character of a person who possesses right view? What is the character of a person who possesses right view? This is the character of a person who possesses right view. Although he may be active in various matters for his companions in the holy life, yet he has keen regard for training in the higher virtue, training in the higher mind, and training in the higher wisdom. Just as a cow with a new calf, while she grazes, watches her calf, so too that is the character of a person who possesses right view. Well, the point here is obviously just that a Sotapanna is always very keen on the training. He never veers very far away from the training in the higher virtue, higher mind, and the higher wisdom. The higher virtue is usually just defined as the Patimokkha Sila for the monks. For lay people, I'm not sure exactly if it is defined for lay people what it means, but it obviously means just a very good standard of virtue, if you like. The higher mind means the jhanas, the deep samadhi states, and the higher wisdom refers to the wisdom that comes when you become an arya. So it's basically the wisdom of the Sotapanna. So the Sotapanna is always keen on developing that wisdom to move on from being a Sotapanna to becoming an arahat. And the person who possesses right view understands thus, I possess the character of a person who possesses right view. This is the fifth knowledge attained by him that is noble, supramundane, not shared by ordinary people. Again, a noble disciple considers thus, do I possess the strength of a person who possesses right view? What is the strength of a person who possesses right view? This is the strength of a person who possesses right view. When the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata is being taught, he heeds it, gives it attention, engages it with all his mind. Hears the Dhamma as with eager ears. This particular character trait of the Buddha, not of the Buddha, of the Sotapanna, sorry, is basically what this means, that when the Sotapanna hears the Dhamma, that is a time when he is able to abandon all the hindrances. And basically that's why he can give his full attention to what is being spoken, because he's able to abandon the hindrances through just listening to the Dhamma. He has this very, very, very keen regard for the Dhamma when it's being spoken. That's what makes it so special. Ordinary people who are not Aryans, they will be able to sort of listen a little bit and would drift off, and you will listen a bit and you would drift off again. You will not be able to have this very, very focused attention. That is, at least most of the time, you won't be able to have that. And that is because the hindrances are basically still there. You're not actually able to abandon those hindrances fully. And that's why this happened. Where the Sotapanna can abandon those hindrances just by listening to the Dhamma, by focusing on the Dhamma. And in other places in the suttas, this is actually said to be one of the ways that somebody who's a Sotapanna can actually move up and attain even higher attainments of enlightenment by simply listening to the Dhamma like this. And through that listening, by abandoning the hindrances, by going through attaining samadhi, he can actually attain higher stages of enlightenment. So this becomes very powerful once you become a Sotapanna. And he understands thus, I do possess the strength of a person who possesses right view. This is the sixth knowledge attained by him that is noble, supramundane, not shared by ordinary people. It's interesting that these things are called strengths. It's not weightlifting or anything, it's actually powers of the mind. Again, a noble disciple considers thus, do I possess the strength of a person who possesses right view? What is the strength of a person who possesses right view? This is the strength of a person who possesses right view. When the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata is being taught, he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. And this, of course, is very closely connected with the previous one, because when you give the reason that the Sotapanna gives such close listens so closely to the Dhamma when it's being spoken is because he has perfect confidence in the Dhamma. So he knows that what he's listening to is very important through that perfect confidence. And because of that perfect confidence, and because he listens so closely, he gets all this joy and inspiration arising in the mind every time he hears the Dhamma properly taught. And the word for the gladness here is this word pamujja, which I spoke about before. So what happens here is that when he gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains inspiration in the meaning, pamujja arises, this gladness arises in his heart. And then the same sequence that I mentioned before starts to arise in his mind. When gladness happens, then piti, this rapture comes up. And when rapture becomes strong, the body and mind become tranquil. As pasadi in Pali, an important aspect in this gradual arising of qualities. And when pasadi, tranquility, becomes strong, then happiness comes up. And then from happiness comes samadhi. That's where the concentration comes. So just from listening to the Dhamma, all these qualities arises in the mind for somebody who's a Sotapanna. And then when samadhi is there, the hindrances are completely abandoned, then the factor of yatha bhuta, jnanadasanam, the seeing of reality, knowledge and vision in accordance with reality, happens. And that's when somebody, Sotapanna, has the opportunity to even become fully enlightened, just by listening to the Dhamma like that. So this is, obviously, this can also happen to, you don't necessarily have to be an Arya or a Sotapanna for this to happen. It can also happen to somebody who's a so-called putujana, an ordinary person. But for a Sotapanna, this will happen regularly, all the time. It's almost like a law, in a sense, for a Sotapanna, that this will happen. For a putujana, okay, if you have a good day, maybe your mind is very clear and very bright, you had a good meditation sit, this may happen. But generally speaking, it won't happen so easily. That's why basically it is a factor for areas for the sotapannas. Okay, so those are the seven qualities. So then this person understands thus: I possess the strength of a person who possesses right view. This is the seventh knowledge attained by him that is noble, supermundane, not shared by ordinary people. When a noble disciple is thus possessed of seven factors, he has well sought the character for realization of the fruit of stream entry. In other words, he has become a stream enter because he has those seven factors. When a noble disciple is thus possessed of seven factors, he does possess the fruit of stream entry. That is what the Blessed One said, and the bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that is the Kosambi Sutta, basically on the qualities of a stream enter. Many of those qualities, of course, are like internal qualities which cannot be directly observed. They are like mental qualities of the stream enter. Yeah. But some of them are are interesting because they are almost like observable things. And for that, can give one a kind of indication, in a sense, what people are doing and where they're at, and maybe even a little bit of indication of where one can place one's faith and where one should be more careful. But one should never take these standards absolutely, of course, because it can be difficult to judge these things. One should be careful in one's judgment, I would generally say. Because if one judges wrong, then that can, of course, lead to many, many kind of problems. Anybody have any questions about this particular sutta? Yes, why not? Okay, they're very closely related. Happiness and contentment are very closely related. You can say that contentment, all these things are things which grow as your meditation practice increases, right? It's not like one thing which is happiness and one thing which is contentment. It's like contentment is a gradual thing. As you practice, you become more and more and more content. And the highest kind of contentment is like when you attain deep samadhi, because the mind is completely content, it's completely still, there's no movement there anymore, just complete contentment. And it's the same with happiness. Happiness sort of begins, sometimes you have this feeling of joy inside the body, you can feel this sort of rapture in the body and the mind. That can be the early stage, it can be that sort of rapture. But then as you become tranquil, you experience a feeling of deeper contentment, so you get this thing called sukha, which is happiness, which is more closely connected with contentment. It's a deeper kind of happiness, in a sense. So you have various degrees of happiness, various degrees of contentment, and as you move along, they become deeper and more powerful and more profound, and more happy, if you like, more content. As you go along. That makes sense. Okay. Good. Yes, John. Yes, basically that's correct. So you have to have very deep samadhi before you can have right view, because you have to actually clear away the five hindrances. The five hindrances are the things which stop you from seeing things as they actually are. And the only way you can really suppress the five hindrances is through deep samadhi. So you have to attain the samadhi first, and then you have right view. Yes. Yes, Ainsley. Okay, yes, you can, because the three lower fetters which have been abandoned in the sotapanna are the fetter of sakkaya ditti, often translated as personality view. It's basically the fetter, that the view that you have some kind of enduring personality inside. Then there is doubt has been abandoned. So that's the second fetter which has been removed, the removal of doubt. And then there is the removal of the belief that rites and rituals can take you all the way to enlightenment, silabhata paramasaha, the clinging, if you like, with attachment to rites and rituals in themselves. So you can, I think you can see quite clearly here that some of these things, for example, the removal of doubt is directly related to the third knowledge here, which is the knowledge that there are no other ascetics and Brahmins outside of the Buddha's dispensation, because the confidence is absolutely perfectly rooted in the Buddha's dispensation. You can see it's directly related to that one. I think the view that you have let go of self-view, that you don't actually have a view, is not actually mentioned here. It doesn't actually relate directly to any of this. I did mention before also briefly about not attaching to rites and rituals. That was actually before I got into the seven factors of Sotapanna. I think you can take, for example, such things that he is able to abandon the five hindrances straight away and enter samadhi. That is a result of having abandoned sakkaya ditti, the personality view. Because you, personality view, you have the sense of being somebody, will tend to block you from letting go, because the reason you can't let go is because you're attached to something. That attachment comes from personality view. So that will be, you can relate it to, actually relate it to that, I would say. Yes. Okay. Okay, anybody else want to ask something? Please ask any question, whether you think it's stupid or not, doesn't really matter. Okay. Yes. I think generally speaking, he will not tend to be obsessed by the five hindrances because of Sotapanna. He will tend to actually be aloof of the five hindrances. So he, generally speaking, he will not be obsessed by those things. As soon as he withdraws and goes back to his kuti or whatever, away from society, away from external impacts, his mind will tend to be pure, because he will always sort of move towards the Dhamma, if you like, and move away from these defilements. So generally speaking, I would say, of course, to a lesser and greater extent, but generally speaking, that would be the inclination of his mind. So you would expect somebody who's Sotapanna, you expect them to be very pure people, expect them not to get angry a lot, not to show great greed or great attachments or anything like that. You might see a little bit of these things, but you wouldn't see much. This is doubt related to the Buddha's teaching here. This is like it relates to the, like doubt about the Four Noble Truths, doubt about the Eightfold Path. Or doubt about that particular vision concerning the Buddha's teachings, but of course doesn't relate to the many topics which will not be covered by that, like ordinary worldly topics, So it really depends. For example, if he has to advise somebody on how to practice their particular practice, he might have doubt as to what is the best thing for them to do. Because if you don't have the ability, you may not be able to recognize somebody's character clearly enough to be able to advise them perfectly. There may be doubt there, but as to their own practice and what they have to do to attain enlightenment, and what the general factors that need to be practiced to attain enlightenment, they wouldn't have any doubt about. They wouldn't have any doubt about the Buddha's teachings, basically. Indeed, so that's particularly when you live like a household life and you live with your family around you all the time, you probably have the hindrances there. But once you draw away and you draw into seclusion, you stay by yourself, then you will tend to abandon those hindrances. But I think as long as you are in the daily routine, the daily life, they will tend to rise quite quickly and quite easily. And you're right, there are many stories in the suttas about lay people, the Sotapannas, who had ordinary family lives. Even Sakkadagamis, once returners, there's one sutta about once returners who were married, living ordinary household life. You're right, there still are, obviously still are, hindrances there, defilements in the mind. Yes, Wayne. Yeah, well, obviously, if you're an anagami, then you would be celibate by definition. you abandon all those, all that defilement completely. Yeah. So yes, yeah, there are. I mean, there are many suttas about, but I mean, imagine being an anagama as a layperson. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? It's pretty remarkable because you don't really have any attachments left. You know, you don't have any attachments for sexuality. You don't have any kind of anger in your mind. Basically, you've gone beyond the world pretty much already. Yeah. So it's quite amazing that there even were such people there. It's a minor precept because it's not really an infringement. This particular rule came about. There was an arahat. I think he actually was Venerable Ananda's upajaya, his preceptor. Yeah. And he decided that he came back from the alms round and he had some food left over after he had eaten. Yeah. So he decided to take the rice and dry it out and eat it the next day. Yeah, because he thought, I don't want to waste this food. So it was in a sense a wholesome intention there behind that. But then the Buddha obviously foresaw consequences of that were obviously not so good for the future of the sasana. So he laid down the rule, monks are not supposed to store food at all. So it's one of those matters of convention, really, that this is not to be done by convention. It was not really an immoral thing as such to store food. It's a minor thing. No. You're banned for that. Well, in the next life, not in that life. Yeah, you can become a samanera if you're really, really keen. You can become a samanera like a novice monk and stay as a novice monk for the rest of your life if you want to. But you can never become a full monk again. Not in that lifetime. I think those seven factors are not found in a group like that anywhere else in the suttas, but they are found like separately in various places. Not as a group. The six qualities, though, are found in many places. You find them, I think, in the Anguttara Sixes, for example. You find those six qualities. The standard, the most standard description of the Sotapanna talks about the four qualities that Sotapanna has. And those four qualities is always the perfect or the full or the unshakable confidence or faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. Because he has seen what the Buddha has seen, his confidence becomes absolutely unshakable, firmly planted. That is the main. And the fourth quality there is that he has, the same which is described here, this unblemished, unblotched virtue that leads to enlightenment. Those are the fourth qualities that are normally mentioned for the Sotapanna, in the suttas. But there are so many suttas, and there are many places there are like things which are mentioned by the Sotapannas, which you could say are qualities of the Sotapannas. I cannot really think of anything right on the spot. I'm sure there are. I know there is more than that which can be considered qualities of Sotapanna, without being able to. The main motivation of Sotapanna is that he has seen the Dhamma. He knows what the Dhamma is all about. He knows that basically samsara is all suffering. There's no point in being here. And we have seen that. He knows that this is all pointless. So his motivation is very, very strong. Much stronger than anybody else because of his unshakable confidence. He knows these things for himself. So he has very strong motivation. And obviously also he understands that he has the ability to teach other people because he has seen something which other people haven't seen. He knows, I must teach these people. This Dhamma is so great, so wonderful, and it can only lead to happiness for whoever comes in contact with it. So I want to teach this to people. And that's the sort of confidence, that's the sort of thing he has. That even motivates him even more to practice hard because he realizes that it would be more beneficial to people. Because one of the differences, if you like, of the Sotapanna and the Arahat and the higher Aryas, because the Sotapanna is not yet fully purified, because there still is some greed and sometimes some anger and some delusion left in the Sotapanna, he won't be as inspiring as an Arahat or an Anagami. They will be much more inspiring because they will be completely pure. It will be almost like faultless. You may never be able to really see any fault. I mean, you might still be able to see fault. That will be one's own imagination, which can happen. But basically, they will be faultless, and most people will be tremendously inspired by such people who are, virtually faultless. That's why Sotapanna probably will still want to practice very, very hard.